I hope that this morning that we'll be challenged as we look into Luke in chapter 14. So I invite you to have that open here with me. We're going to look at God's rules for a banquet. God's rules and how we should be when we go to a banquet. And Jesus uses a great opportunity to teach in the moment. And maybe you've attended some dinner or some type of thing where you weren't quite sure how things would go. Check out this video and see if you can see, you know, the awkwardness of what's going on, what's happening here. Check this out. Let's see if this plays for us.
Puis-je recommander le plateau de fruits de mer? Oui?
Oui.
Le plateau de fruits de mer.
Maybe some of you shudder a little bit. That's good, guys. You can shut it off there. Maybe some of you guys shudder a little bit when you think about that because you've tried oysters. But have you ever been in a setting where you weren't quite sure how to act? You go to a dinner, and you maybe have felt that way a little bit when you weren't sure where to sit, weren't sure how to conduct yourself. And in Luke chapter 14, I bet you to have a Bible open with me here this morning as we look through these verses here in Luke chapter 14. Jesus attends a banquet, and we're going to look at God's banquet rules. Here, let's start by setting this up a little bit so we know where they're at and what the setting is here. We see in chapter 14, verse 1, we see that it's on the Sabbath and that Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee. He was being carefully watched. We see here that it was a Sabbath, and it was common in their culture to get together after they went to the synagogue. Similar to church here. Oftentimes we'll get together for lunch afterwards, or a Packer game if it's football season, or we'll do different things together. And Jesus here was invited to go along to this prominent Pharisee's house. Now this The word there, prominent, I think helps us get a little glimpse to this was the who's who type of dinner. I mean, these were the people that were the prominent Pharisees, and it was the people from the community that were important, and they were all invited there. And we see that Jesus is there, and they're watching Jesus carefully. I don't know. I did some research, and here in this passage, we don't really know where the disciples are. I don't know if they're kind of in the back, on the side. We don't see any dialogue in this first part here talking to them directly, so I don't know where they fit into this picture, how they were watching this. But we see here that the relationship between Jesus, if you know the story of the Gospels, and you see that how Jesus relates with the Pharisees. They're not really yet to the wanting to kill him phase. They're curious. They might be wanting to trip him up, wanting to ask him questions to see what he would say, and so they have this type of relationship going on here with the Pharisees. Now, meals were important in their culture. Like they're important here too, right? We enjoy eating, and in their culture also, they loved getting together, and a big part of life was eating together and sharing that time and talking, and oftentimes at these types of meals, the Pharisees would talk about lessons, talk about the things that they had learned earlier in a synagogue, and it was very common for them to invite a teacher from the synagogue to teach them further and to talk more about the things that they had learned, possibly teaching that was going on that day or other questions that they had. What we see here, we're skipping on down, we see here that Jesus notices in verse 7 through 14, we're going to focus in on those, the teaching that Jesus gives in those verses. Jesus notices how the guests pick their places of honor at the table, and then he tells them a parable. Experts in management tell us that most people wear an invisible sign. It says, "Please make me feel important." And it's true. We need people to do all different kinds of jobs. But the truth about the human heart is that we want to be noticed. We want to feel important. Maybe you've worked for a boss that you can maybe think of. As students, I think of this because oftentimes when we start out in the work field, your boss has you doing like the worst jobs ever, right? You know, cleaning the bathrooms at the grocery store or something like that, you know? But have you ever worked for a boss that made you feel so important for doing even the lowliest jobs? A boss that was good at that, or a manager maybe that could, you did a great job at that. Thank you for doing that. And you feel that importance, and that is the human heart. We want to feel important. And in Jesus' day, the same as today, people were looking for status symbols that helped them enhance or protect their standing in society. The emphasis here was on reputation, not character. We'll talk about this more as we expand this passage, but it was more important for these Pharisees to sit in the right places than to live the right kind of life. Well, Jesus here, we see in verse 7 that he didn't wait for a discrete time to pull people aside. He just, let's talk about it. He notices the way they pick their seats, and he brings it up. He says this. He says, "When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may come that has been invited." I think this is interesting. Like, I was thinking about this. When do we feel this importance to grab a seat? You know, I mean, I don't think that when you come to, if you were to come to dinner in my house, I don't know that we usually think about that, but I was thinking about this, like, when do we feel this big push to grab seats? Maybe at a concert? You know what I saw recently? Is I flew, and they have this great thing now called open seating. Oh, it's not a good idea. I'm not a fan of it. They have this thing when, ladies and gentlemen, you know, they make the announcement, and we're now going to begin boarding, and it's like a mad rush to the gate. And I'm the type of person, I'm a little bit long, and so I don't fit well in some seats, so it's okay for me to wait to get on the plane, because I don't need to get on there and then sit for half an hour while everybody else tries to jam their bags in the overhead compartments. And so we just wait. And what are the most important seats on that airplane? The first ones, right? And then what else? The window or the... Nobody wants to be in the middle, right? You don't get an elbow, like it's taken, and you try to get your tray down. You know, it's so, you guys know, right? And the Pharisees at this dinner came in, and they were jockeying for position. Now listen, I have a couple of photos here. I want to show you what this may have looked like. These aren't photos. These are paintings. But it's their day photo, right? Whatever. So this may have been what it may have looked like. Imagine a low table. where they would recline and sit around, and the seats that were most important. Go ahead and show the other one also. There's the seats that were most important were by the host. Okay? And so if it was a type of table that was in a U-shaped pattern or a round table like this, the seats that were most important were to the right and left of the host. And then in declining order of importance from there. So the furthest away would be the least important or the least honored seat. Not necessarily the least important, but Jesus notices how... I was thinking about how this might have happened, you know, like maybe the older ones were a little bit slower, and so the younger ones, they're like, they get in there to the dinner and they do whatever they need to. Maybe they're like putting their cloak on a seat to save it, right? Or maybe they physically like got in the seat and they're like, selfie, look, I got the first, I'm in the spot one number one, you know, and they're like tweeting or status update, yeah, I'm in seat number three, or I don't know. Maybe not. If you don't know what that is, that's okay. So Jesus takes notice of this, and he's like, I'm going to teach a little bit about that. And so I think this is interesting because teaching in the moment is powerful, right? And some of you that are parents do this so well. When you have a teachable moment with kids, and it's like, hey, listen, let's talk about this. And so Jesus notices this. I wonder where Jesus was when this was all happening. You know, people are trying to get their spots and sit next to the host, and he's pointing this out. And it may have seemed a little bit awkward that Jesus is like, hey, let me give you guys a lesson on social manners here. You know? And he shares this. These verses here, 8, 9, 10. Let me read it together, and then we'll pull out some ideas here. He says this, when someone invites you to a wedding feast, don't take the place of honor. For a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this man your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. Jesus here is giving some advice. If you want to avoid humiliation, listen, if you want to avoid disgrace or shame, he says, pick your place carefully. And our point here is that be humble and be careful where you sit. When you sit, there may be somebody else that is more important to you. That the shame in this is not that you would have to move, but it would be the shame could come from the host as a standpoint of like, hey, I got to address this awkward issue now. Listen, this other person is more important than you, and the host would have to come over and say, listen, could you move down, please? Or maybe you would get moved all the way down if those other seats were already full. I like this Proverbs, verse 25, verse 6 and 7 says this, when you stand before the king, don't try to impress him and pretend that you're important. It's better to be asked to take a higher position than to be told to give your place to someone more important. Honor, this type of honor that we seek, can't be claimed, can't be taken. It's given by God. And this, Jesus is using this as a picture of how things will be in God's kingdom. As we look around the world around us, oftentimes the people that get the honor that are here with us now are the people that sees that, right? But not so in God's kingdom. So what is humility? What does it look like? Before we get to that, let me tell you what it's not. The opposite of humility would be what? Arrogance? Pridefulness? It would be the type of person that would rather talk than listen. This person may dominate the conversations that they're in. They always have to be right. They think they're the best, and they treat other people as inferior. They're unteachable, unbendable. They know it all, and they always have to one-up other people. humility also is not some people that try to give this appearance of humility in order to manipulate the feelings of others or to have them do something for them. And some people also think that humility is letting other people put you down or walk or have their way and walk all over you. It's not that. I found a quote, and it was in so many different places that I couldn't figure out who actually said it. So can I just leave it as it was a popular quote that says this, that humility is not thinking meanly of ourselves. It's just not thinking about ourselves at all. Have you ever listened to an interview after a championship game? It usually falls into two categories, right? We just had March Madness, or think about the Super Bowl or something. And they bring up this player. Usually the star players get the microphone, right? And they bring them up in front of people, and usually the talks go two ways. Usually, right? And they put the microphone in their face, and they say, tell us about the road to get here to this championship, and now you've won it. And usually you will hear, I worked so hard, I sacrificed so much, I gave this, and I worked, and I knew if I dreamed I could do it, and it's I, and me. Or on the flip side, have you heard those athletes say, there are others on this team that sacrificed more than I did to get us here. I stood on their shoulders and they lifted me up. But they're the heroes. And they helped get us here. And we work together. You hear this teamwork type of thing. And they know their place. That's humility. And that's greatness. Listen to this. Once upon a time, there was... This is a true story. And it started with once upon a time, but... True story, there was a writer in plain clothes that came across a few soldiers who were trying to move a heavy log out of a roadway. And there was a corporal standing there watching as the men struggled to work together to move this log. And the writer asked them, he says, why aren't you... The writer, the plainclothes writer, asked the corporal, why aren't you helping your men move this log? It looks like they could use another hand. The corporal replied, I'm the corporal. I give the orders. The writer said nothing in response and said he dismounted his horse, went up and stood by the soldiers and helped them move the log from the roadway. And with his help, they were finally able to clear the roadway. And who was this kind writer? It was George Washington, the commander-in-chief. He quietly remounted his horse and said to the corporal, the next time your men need help, send for the commander-in-chief. I recently read a short biography. You have a picture of George Washington there. I recently was reading a short biography of George Washington. I don't know what you think about when you see his picture on the dollar bill or you see a painting like this. My admiration for this man grew as I read how he led our country. George Washington, he led out of humility. And, you know, the stories about him being a brave fighter and a bold man and having bullet holes in his clothes after fighting and having horses shot out from underneath of him, those are stories of greatness. But the stories that aren't so popular about his humility and how he led, think about this. He was our first president. And what did he have to base this idea of a presidency on? Who was before him? He had examples of kings, of tyrants that he had fought against now. In fact, after George Washington had defeated the world power of the time, right? They were fighting for their independence, and he had just defeated the army. And King George III said this about George Washington. When he heard about George Washington setting up the presidency and then leaving it after he had served his term to go farm in Virginia, this is what he said. King George said that he, referring to George Washington, is the greatest man in the world. That he would have that power, that that influence, and walk away from it. And I really saw that as such an example of humility that really is not something that we see promoted. We don't see that praised in students. We don't see that praised in people at work. And Jesus here is giving instruction to these Pharisees. And he says to them, this is how God's kingdom should look. Be humble. Know your place. It's much better to be honored by God. God will make the final seating arrangements. Our small group is going through a study by John Schneider. I don't know if you know the name, but he said this quote in one of his sermons, and I thought this was important. And I've been saying it to our youth group. And so he says this about humility. He says, humility is the start of knowing God. And he says, there is no room for God in a proud person's heart. There's no room for God in a proud person's heart because it's full of themselves. And Jesus is addressing these Pharisees that are all working for a position. They're all trying to get their spots like a Southwest flight. And they're all trying to get in there. And he uses this time to teach. The last verse that I did not read here, Jesus says this. He says, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. What does that sound like? Something that you've heard before? For the last will be first, and the first will be last. Well, Jesus goes on here in verse 12, and he begins to address the host now. Talk about awkward. Let's pick on these people, and now let me say something to you, the person throwing the party. I have to admit that I see some serious boldness happening here. Let me teach you all a lesson, and then let me teach you a lesson, host. Verse 12, Jesus said this to his host. He says, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, don't invite your friends, your brothers or relatives, or your rich neighbors. For if you do, they might invite you back so that you will be repaid. We don't know what Jesus saw as far as knowing the motives of this host, but we can guess, right, by what he said. Maybe the host had invited these people to pay them back for parties that he had been invited to. It's like, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours, type of, hey, we'll throw these fancy parties and invite our fancy friends. But maybe he had invited some other people that he wanted to put in his debt. That if I invite them to my party, maybe the next time they throw one of their important parties, I'll get into theirs. There may have been some ulterior motives, and we can guess at those. I don't know. But Warren Wiersbe says here, is Jesus saying don't ever have dinner with your friends, your family, or wealthy people? Is Jesus saying don't ever? No. Warren Wiersbe says this. He says, Jesus does not prohibit us from entertaining family and friends. He's not saying don't ever get together. But he's warning us about only or exclusively entertaining family and friends. So we have to ask ourselves, is my party list, is it exclusive? Is it habitual? Do I have the same people over and over? And it's easy to do. man, working with students, students feel comfortable who they go to school with. So when you have a youth group and you have students come from all these different schools in the area, who are they going to gravitate to? Their friends. And I don't see that in the family of God that we should stay in our groups. I try to get everybody together. Hey, do you know these guys? And do you know what's interesting is how much you see an appreciation grow for somebody at a, for somebody that's at a different school. You know, you make friends and you realize, I really enjoy being with them. And Jesus here is not saying, don't ever have dinner with your, you know, don't avoid these people, your friends. Don't ignore your friends. But is it something that's exclusive? This type of hospitality may have been not an expression of love and grace, but an evidence of pride in the host's heart. Maybe it was pride and selfishness that he had invited these guests. Maybe even why he had invited Jesus. And Jesus is pointing that out. And he's saying, be hospitable. This is who you should invite to your banquet. Let's go on and read this next verse here. He says, Jesus says, but when you give a banquet, this is who to invite. He says, but when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, the least, the last, and the lost. Okay? Jesus says, but when you give a banquet, invite these people. Now listen, they already knew this. In fact, it was common that when you threw a dinner, that you would invite some people that were like that. Some people that were least, the last, and the lost. Some people that were poor, crippled, and lame. They would do that. But my guess is that was probably for a show. Were those people first on the list? Let me see. Let me make up my list. Say, who are going to invite? Okay, friends. Let's bring some prominent people in. Put them on the list. Oh, yeah, we better make this look good. Let's invite, some of these other people that, you know, are from the orphanage or whatever, you know. And so Jesus points this out, and he's like saying to them, this is what God's kingdom is about. This is who to invite to your banquet. Why? Because these people cannot pay us back. These people could never throw a banquet or a meal or do something great for them. And this is where your reward is. You know, how often, I was thinking about this and I thought, how often do we make serving others and attach that with a reward? I probably didn't say that the best, but when we take students to serve in a place, do we always have to attach that with, and you're going to make $50, or do you know what I mean? Do we have to attach that with a reward, and we'll go out for ice cream afterwards? Just do this, and then you get the reward. I think about that as a parent, too, teaching my kids. How do we parent in a way that just relishes in the joy of serving, the joy of giving, the joy in making somebody else feel important? And we have to attach, you know, it's been very, people are so generous, you know. I think about it, I do something with the kids, and you know, and we try to help out at grandma's house, or we do something somewhere, and they get a sucker or something, and it's like, no, my kids aren't here, so I can tell you this. Don't give them the sucker. Just let them. You know what I mean? And we have to test our hearts, our motives, and say, are we happy just to serve? Verse 14 is where we see the promise, a reward here. It says, Jesus says, when you give this banquet, invite these people, the poor, the crippled, lame, blind, and you will be blessed. There's a promise there, a reward. This blessing isn't something that we receive instantly. It doesn't come as a form of a rebate in the mail. It isn't a credit that you get on your credit card. It is a reward that is given by God. Often we want the instant reward, right? We want the instant payoff. We ask the question, well, what's in it for me? If I go do this, what am I going to gain from it? I think that it's so important that we say, well, you know, what does it profit a man if you gain the whole world and yet lose your soul? Some things, they seem so important, but they're really not. And this passage is reminding us that there's value in giving, and God sees our kindness. Don't we forget that there's a God that sees us? Or do we start to think that because we don't see Him, He doesn't see us? And so back in Luke 6, it says this, listen to this, and if you lend to those whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? If you loan and then you expect to receive, even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend without expecting anything in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be the sons of the Most High, for He is King to the ungrateful and the evil. I'm sorry, for He is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. That's from Luke chapter 6. Jesus here is challenging the motives of the Pharisees, the heart issues that are below the fancy robes, the outer shell, the actions that they want everybody to see. And I look at this and I say, I struggle with the same heart issues. We do. We're people. We're human. And so Jesus here says, be humble. Know your place. And be hospitable. Give. But give as though you're giving unto the Lord, not expecting any return. This, I should note here at the end of verse 14, he says, you will be blessed. And then it says, although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid as the resurrection of the righteous. Jesus spoke about this resurrection of the righteous, but he also spoke about the resurrection of the unrighteous. There's a difference there. And when we talk about this, Jesus is laying out kingdom values. His kingdom is different than the kingdom we see, the place we live in. And He's calling us to be humble and be givers, and to be givers, be hospitable. Listen to this. Pastor Gary found this illustration. I think this will help us tie it together as we think about heart issues. John Blanchard stood up from the bench. He straightened his army uniform and he studied the crowd of people that were making their way through Grand Central Station. He looked for the girl whose heart he knew, but whose face he didn't. The girl with the rose. His interest in her had begun 13 months before in a Florida library. He had taken a book off the shelf, and he found himself intrigued, not with the words in the book, but with the notes that were penciled in the margins. The soft handwriting reflected a thoughtful soul and an insightful mind. In the front of the book, inside the cover, he discovered the previous owner's name, Miss Hollis Mano. And with time and effort, he located her address. She lived in New York City, and he wrote to her a letter introducing himself and inviting her to correspond. Shortly after, he was shipped overseas for service in World War II. During the next year and so, they grew to know each other through the mail. Each letter was a seed that was falling on a fertile heart. A romance was budding, right? Blanchard requested a photograph, but she refused. She felt that if he really cared, it wouldn't matter what she looked like. When the day finally came for him to return from Europe, they scheduled their first meeting. It was to be 7 o'clock p.m. at the Grand Central Station in New York. "You'll recognize me," she said, "by the red rose I'll be wearing on my shirt." So, at 7 o'clock, he was in the station looking for the girl whose heart he loved, but whose face he'd never seen. A young woman was walking directly toward him. Her figure was long and slim, and her hair was blonde and curly, and from her delicate ears, and her eyes were blue as flowers, and her lips... I'm trying to be serious here. her lips and chin had a gentle firmness, and in her pale green suit, she looked like springtime come alive. Mr. Blanchard stared towards her, entirely forgetting to notice that she was not wearing a rose. As he moved, she smiled at him. "Going my way, soldier?" she murmured. Almost uncontrollably, he made one step closer to her, and then he saw Hollis Mano. She was standing almost directly behind the girl. A woman that was well past 40. She had graying hair tucked under a worn hat. She was plump, and her feet were thrust into worn shoes. The girl in the green suit was walking quickly away, and Lieutenant Blanchard felt as though he was split in two. For the woman whose spirit had truly companioned him and upheld his own, there she stood, her pale face was gentle and sensible, and her gray eyes were warm and kind. John did not hesitate. His fingers gripped the small, worn blue leather copy of the book that would identify him to her. This would not be love, he thought, but it would be something precious, something perhaps even better than love, a friendship for which he had been grateful for these years. He squared his shoulders, saluted, and held out the book to the woman. Even though while he spoke, he felt choked by the bitterness and disappointment. "I'm Lieutenant John Blanchard, and you must be Miss Mano. I'm so glad we could meet. May I take you to dinner?" The woman's face broadened into a smile. She said, "I don't know what this is about, son, but the young lady in green suit begged me to wear this rose on my coat. And she said that if you were to ask me out to dinner, that I should tell you that she is waiting for you in the restaurant across the street. She said it was some kind of test." Jesus here was testing the hearts of the Pharisees. He was pointing out issues. And when we look at this, I see issues in my heart, and I feel like as I look at the things that God's kingdom is about, it's about the least, the last, and the lost. It's about giving and not expecting repayment. How do we measure up? We know that as we live out our life blessed by God and given so much by Him, that we could never repay. We could never repay Him. How do we measure up? Let me pray. God, I pray that we as people would humbly bow before you. That would be our starting point. That our knees would bow. We would claim you as Lord of our life. And I pray that as we come to know you better, to realize our place, I pray that we'd be able to live out our gratefulness for who you are, what you have done in our life, and what you have blessed us with. And God, I pray that this morning, as we've been challenged by this passage, that we would be able to give freely, and that we would be able to test our hearts of, do we truly love the least and the last and the lost? Where is our spot? God, I pray that that we would be able to live for you. I ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.